It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll get a glimpse of life on the road with a Wisconsin man who spent two decades as a guitar technician for acts like the Eagles, Fleetwood Mac, and Ringo Starr.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news, the Wisconsin News Roundup.
A congressional seat from Wisconsin will be up for grabs this fall after a state representative announced that he's not going to be running for re-election.
And Milwaukee County officials want to remove a number of youths currently living at the Lincoln Hills Correctional Facility.
For the latest on those stories and more, we're joined by Robert Menser, a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network based in central Wisconsin. Robert, welcome back.
Hi, thanks.
So on Monday of this week, U.S. Representative Reed Ribble from Northeast Wisconsin announced that he won't be running for re-election this fall. What's the story there?
Yeah, so that's the 8th congressional district. It includes Green Bay and Appleton, a lot of sort of Fox Valley, northeastern Wisconsin area. So that has set off a bit of a scramble in both parties to put forward good candidates. They see the open seat as a good opportunity. Before this, there was a Democratic challenger to Ribble who was a university professor named Ron Gruitt. And this week, it is suddenly an extremely popular race to consider getting into. So there are a long list of Republicans who have thought about, you know, so that they are thinking about throwing their hat in the ring, and several Democrats as well.
And before we get into those names, it sounds like this news kind of hit everybody by surprise.
Yeah, Ribble was sort of part of the Tea Party wave, but he was never really, he was not a guy who was extremely sort of connected with Republican leadership. He had been a businessman before he got into politics. He went in saying that he was only going to serve a few terms. Still, though, I don't think people expected that he would get out this year. He'd had some friction with party leaders. Like, even an example of this, he was the first, and I think the only member of Wisconsin's delegation to publicly come out and say that he would not support Donald Trump if Trump became the Republican nominee. And so it sort of felt like maybe he just wasn't really feeling the party politics. And I think that Republicans would have probably preferred to have him stick it out and retire in a midterm election. But they'll have to field a new candidate this year.
And what has Rebel said about why he's not running again?
So the usual things that you say. He wants to spend time with his family. He's getting on to retirement age. But you know, like I said, he was in this sort of Tea Party Freedom Caucus. He declared that he left that caucus, but he never really fit in with any groups in a certain way in Congress. And so I think he just wasn't feeling it.
All right, let's get to that list now. Who's throwing their hat into the ring and who's sort of thinking about it right now?
Sure. So here's what we know. State Senator Roger Roth, some people said, was a likely candidate. He declared that he will not seek this seat. He's a Republican state senator. He's out. So I think a lot of people think that Assembly Representative John Nygren, who's a leader on the state's budget committee, is a likely Republican who may run. He said he's considering running. But there's a whole bunch. Senator Frank Lassie, Representative Andre Jacques, sort of up and down that corridor. There are a number of Republicans who are, you know, at least potential people to take that on. On the Democratic side, the former Assembly Representative Penny Bernard Schaber said that she's considering it, and Outagamie County Executive Thomas Nelson, who used to be in the legislature, is also thinking about jumping in.
And I also saw at least one name that seems surprising, one of the owners of Al Johnson's Swedish restaurant in Door County.
Sure, I like that place. Why not?
So lots of different names, and I guess we'll have to watch that one, see how it develops.
Yep, indeed.
And we're going to talk now about a group of lawmakers looking at changing the state's asset forfeiture law. What can you tell us about those changes?
So this is an interesting bill. This had a hearing this week in Madison, so we're definitely in the early stages. It hasn't passed out of committee, much less gotten a full vote. But it's an interesting initiative, and certainly it's worth watching. So this is a practice that, to some degree, has been increasingly in the public eye. Following there was a long story in the New Yorker about this a couple years ago, and through some activism. What it is there are a lot of situations where police seize stuff, take stuff from people in the course of an investigation. So that could be, a suitcase full of drug money or a drug dealer's car that they're using to deliver heroin. The police departments might take that in the course of the investigation, and that is sort of understandable, and that's how it's supposed to work. If that stuff is gotten illegally, you wouldn't really expect for then the state to then sort of give back that suitcase full of drug money. But what if that person's never convicted, or what if the police just had it wrong and that this stuff wasn't illegally gotten? There are actually a lot of cases, and it's been documented, it's not just in Wisconsin, it's all over the country, where police don't need to give that stuff back, even if there's no charges ever filed. In a lot of cases, police departments are allowed, and this is true in Wisconsin, to use assets that they've seized for their own budget, to fund their own budget. So people argue, and you can understand why, there's an incentive there to take more stuff, and there's a movement now. This is a bill sponsored by a Republican state senator, but it's quite bipartisan, at least in this early stage, that would redirect some of that funds to a different budget to remove that incentive, and would require a conviction before the state is allowed to permanently seize those assets.
So where is this one in the process, and what's going to be next for it?
So it's way early. It would have to pass out of committee. There was the hearing did indicate what the sort of the shape of the debate will be if it does go forward in this committee. And there were representatives of law enforcement saying that this would have a fiscal impact, which it would. I mean, there are a lot of law enforcement departments that this is like a regular and expected part of their budget, and they might fund a drug unit or something. So they argue that you can't take away these funds. They need them to operate, and it will I think it'll be a challenge for lawmakers to overcome that argument. But some states have done it. It has happened, and there's sort of an interesting kind of right-left alliance. So it will be something to see if it gets some support behind it.
We're catching up on the biggest stories out of Wisconsin right now with Robert Menser, storytelling editor for USA Today Network based in central Wisconsin. And Robert, we're going to check in right now on Lincoln Hills. We've been watching this developing story at the youth facility there, allegations of abuse, sexual abuse, physical abuse, all kinds of things. Where are we on that? What's the latest?
Sure. Well, probably there were a couple pieces of news this week. Probably, perhaps the most significant is the Milwaukee County Board reacted to these sort of ongoing problems in the probe at Lincoln Hill by advancing a proposal that would actually pull out 170 youth who are at the facility. The facility, of course, is in Lincoln County, Wisconsin, north central Wisconsin. They would take 170 youth who are from the Milwaukee area and transfer them to a secure detention center in Milwaukee County. So it's just a first step toward that. But if it went forward, that would reshape everything about Lincoln Hills. Those 170 kids turn out to be 70% of the youth who are at Lincoln Hills. So it would definitely change what type of institution they have up there.
And does Milwaukee County have the capacity to absorb those youth who might be coming in?
They do not. They voted. They have there is a secure detention center, and it can hold people for about half a year. And there is a vote to expand that capacity. It also, it's tremendously expensive. It is worth saying there needs to be sort of counselors and mental health services besides just sort of guards and the type of sort of prison staff that you expect. They need programs as well for these juveniles. So this is a vote this is the first step toward clearing that space and making sure that they have the capacity for that. But it's I think it's fair to say that it's quite a long road before they would be able to complete that transition.
And in terms of the investigation in general, where is that?
So, and a piece of news this week, there was one specific instance of alleged abuse, but it was one of the more more shocking ones, where there was a child whose arm or wrist was broken in custody, and there was some new information reported this week that the staffer who was involved in that specific incident, Kyle Hoff, had been cleared of wrongdoing by, I guess, now two separate probes. He's not the subject of ongoing investigations. So they said that that happened while a juvenile was taking off a pair of handcuffs. It looks like it wasn't maybe handled the right way. He was never put on administrative leave, as the institution is supposedly should. But that was a case where, in that at least this one specific instance, it doesn't appear that there's going to be any criminal charges out of that.
Robert, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much.
That was news editor Robert Menser helping us recap the biggest news stories from around the state of Wisconsin this week.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
Life on the road with the Eagles.
On a dark desert highway, cool wind in my hair, warm smell of colitas rising up.
When Eagles frontman Glenn Frey died last month at the age of 67, there was a sense of loss for fans around the world and also close to home here in Wisconsin. Todd Bowie's been a sound engineer and stagehand for acts like the Fleetwood Mac, the Flaming Licks and Lips, and Beck, but his strongest memories came from his time working with the Eagles.
These days, Todd Bowie's an instructor at the Madison College Visual Communications and Media Design Program, and he joins us now to talk about his time with the Eagles and other high-profile bands. Todd, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Veronica and Rob. Thanks a lot for having me.
Well, you're a musician yourself, so how did you end up working alongside huge names like Glenn Frey, Ringo Starr, and Beck?
Well, I actually was living in Los Angeles at the time. This would have been the mid to late 80s. And I was hired as a sound engineer and operations manager at a studio out there called 3E. And 3E was a code name for the Third Encore. And I didn't know it at the time, but the Third Encore was kind of a code name for the Eagles' after-show parties in their 70s heyday. And the studio was owned by this old New Jersey guy named Norton. And his real name was Bob Thompson, but everyone called him Norton. He was actually the son of Art Carney from the Honeymooners. And he looked just like his dad, but I guess I don't think he had seen his dad in a long time. But the other interesting thing about Norton was he was an old crew member of the Eagles during their 70s heyday. And I think that, I don't really know the details of this, but Glenn Frey had some kind of interest in the studio. I don't know if it was a financial interest or was just kind of helping Norton get off his feet and get started, but Glenn would use the studio quite a bit himself for his solo band. This would have been the time that the Eagles were separated for their 14-year hiatus thing there. And yeah, I just I started to serve as a sound engineer at the studio and kind of got to know Glenn a little bit when he was around. And one day they knew that I played guitar myself, and one day I was asked if I'd be willing to fly with Glenn and his solo band to some one-off date somewhere in the Midwest to serve as a guitar technician. And it was nothing really I ever aspired to do, but I decided to give it a try and do it, and I actually really enjoyed it. I had a great time, and I actually made more money on that weekend than I did the whole week at the studio, so I started to do it more and more. And during those, you know, few trips that we did on those one-offs with Glenn, I ended up meeting Joe Walsh, who would frequently come and join Glenn's solo band. And I, you know, started to develop a relationship with Joe, and eventually Joe brought me on full time as his personal assistant and guitar technician and sound engineer, and I ended up working for Joe for about the next 13 years or so. And the rest was all downhill from there, I guess.
So you were tuning guitars, you mentioned, but as a sound engineer, a backline technician, I understand too. What all did you do for bands like the Eagles?
Well, a guitar technician may sound easy, but it was anything but. It was actually a really, really complicated job. Number one, you had to work with, you know, high-profile stars like the Eagles and others, and manage and take care of really complicated systems. It's not as simple as plugging a guitar in. For instance, for Joe, who I served as guitar tech for the entire Eagles Hell Freezes Over tour, I mean, I carried about, I think, 35 instruments for Joe alone for one night. You know, so there were numerous spares, and it was a very, very complicated system I was in charge of. And, you know, you don't want anything to happen when you're out in front of 80,000 people. And there was a lot of pressure on that entire band and crew for that reunion. You know, it was a lot of pressure on them after being broken up for 14 years. And so, yeah, there was a... There was a lot of stress going on there, and the other thing that was thrown in was Joe had was recently in recovery at that time for alcoholism. He was in pretty rough shape when I first met him in the late 80s, and but he really came around and cleaned up his act in the early 90s, and they were able to reunite, and that ended up being, you know, one of the most successful reunions in music history, really.
We're talking to Todd Bowie right now, instructor and lab coordinator for the Madison College, talking about his nearly two decades as a backline technician, sound engineer for bands and performers like the Eagles, Glenn Frey, Fleetwood Mac, and the Flaming Lips. And so you got to know these guys on a personal level. Todd, did you ever get to just sit around and jam to make music with some of the most famous musicians of their day?
Yeah, you know, it's I have to kind of pinch myself at times to really believe that that happened to me, but I did. I actually was very close with really Joe, especially. Glenn was the one who brought me in and, you know, kind of gave me my start and gave me my first chance of doing that kind of work. But it was Joe who I really developed a close relationship with. And, you know, I was one of two best men at one of his marriages. And did a lot for him personally at his home, and he'd send me out to get bananas for him and stuff. And just a really great guy, very interesting guy, you know, very intelligent. The Eagles were all super talented people, and you know, the success that they had and the mark they made on music, you know, didn't come easy, and they really deserved that success and that that they had. And man, they had a lot of it. They really did well and really left their mark on music, especially American rock and roll. You know, they were one of the most successful American bands. So there are a lot of stories, some of them good, some of them bad, but all very memorable.
Well, of all the bands and people you worked with, where was the most fun? What was the most fun tour you were part of?
The most fun. You know, they were all fun. They were all in their own way. They were all tough in their own way. They were all interesting. You know, some of the traveling that's involved, and especially on the level of the Eagles, you know, we would travel in style, and we would go to the biggest venues and the best venues, especially for that tour, because it ended up being so successful for them. It's really hard for me to answer that. There were some really, really memorable dates that we did. The Hell Freezes Over lasted from like 94 till about 96, I guess. And then, you know, during 97, we would do a lot of fundraisers for the Clintons when Bill Clinton was running for reelection for his second term. And, you know, it seems like every time I would look at my monthly schedule in 97, you know, every week we'd be doing something different for the Clintons. And it got to the point where I was like, oh, I got to go meet the president again this week, yawn, you know, whatever. So it was, I don't know. It was just, that was very memorable. And then, of course, you know, the Eagles' 25th anniversary was a big deal, and that was at the Aspen Opera House. And a lot of Glenn's friends were there, Jack Nicholson and people. And Glenn was a very avid golfer and really a big sports enthusiast. And so we would perform at a lot of celebrity golf events and stuff. And, you know, there were always, you know, big name stars like Clint Eastwood and all these people who were kind of rubbing elbows with us. And, you know, when you go to your job every day and you're, you know, standing next to, I don't know,
legends.
Yeah, they're just these people. It was just kind of a dream, you know, going through all that. And, you know, I'm not saying it was all fun, but it was definitely memorable, you know.
And so how do you go from that, standing next to legends, meeting the president, jetting around, traveling in style, to living in Wisconsin? How did you make that transition back here?
What happened was, I guess it was probably after It was in the early 2000s. There was quite a bit of turmoil in the Eagles organization with the firing of one of the members, a guy named Don Felder. You know, there's a, I won't get into all that, but there was a, there's a great Eagles documentary out right now. It's about 4 hours long, and it's really a great, great movie, and it kind of tells the story about what happened. But when that happened, there was some kind of restructuring that went on, and you know how that stuff kind of floats downhill, and I was just a little disillusioned, and I think more than anything, I just got a little burnt out. You know, it's kind of a tough life, and it doesn't really leave you any room to do anything else in your life. And I ended up going back to my home in New England for a time, and then started a small studio in Lake Geneva, actually, in Chicago, with one of my Eagles friends, one of my colleagues, and started to travel from New England out to Wisconsin more and more. And on one of my trips, I met my beautiful wife, Liz, and it's all been uphill since then.
Todd Bowie's an instructor and lab coordinator for the Madison College. He spent two decades touring as a technician for bands like Fleetwood Mac and the Eagles. Todd, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, guys.
Well, I'm running down the road trying to loosen my load. I got 7 women on my mind. 4 that want to own me, 2 that want to stone me, 1 says she's a friend of mine. Take it easy, take it easy. Don't let the sound of your...
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard.
For many rural areas and small towns, churches are a central part of community life. In addition to their role as places of worship, they've traditionally been a place where people come together, a source of social connection and support.
But there's been concern that these churches may be on the decline. Some congregations face declining numbers, and staff is stretched thin.
Two guests join us now. Liz Lenz is a writer and blogger. She wrote a piece in Pacific Standard titled The Death of the Midwestern Church. She's based in Iowa. Liz, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Also with us is Wayne Thompson, sociology professor at Carthage College in Kenosha. He focuses on religion. He's worked as a researcher with a variety of denominations. Wayne, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Liz, you write that small town churches in Iowa and elsewhere are facing challenges. Some, including your own church, have closed. How important have these churches been to people in those communities?
Well, I think for a long time, the local parish, the local church, has been a community center. It's been the place where people in rural communities have come together, you know, on a weekly basis. It's where sports, where, you know, people used to have baseball teams and softball teams and potlucks. So it's more than, I think, just a house of worship. It's been really functional, important community centers. And then as, you know, transportation has made things, made it easier to travel, and people have stopped attending church as much, that these local parishes are really finding it hard to stay alive, basically.
And Wayne, are we seeing similar challenges facing these small town and rural parishes, congregations here in Wisconsin?
Yes, Rob, the dynamics are very similar. There's been a decline going on since about 1980 in rural areas. The decline in church membership for urban areas started a little bit earlier in the late 1960s. So like everything, it takes a little bit longer to hit in the rural communities, but we have seen long-term sustained decline, and all the things that Liz was talking about with churches merging, sharing resources, and people commuting for work to other towns, not having much tie to their communities. And I would add to that also a sense of loss about the past. The difference with Wisconsin is that Wisconsin is more Catholic, somewhat more urban, and about 25% Catholic versus, I think, 17% in Iowa. Iowa's more Protestant, more Methodist. Both states have a lot of Lutherans in them. Both states have a lot of rural congregations and small town congregations that serve rural populations.
And Liz, for the piece you wrote, you talked to some pastors and other local leaders. What do they talk about? How are they trying to adapt to maybe recapture that sense? First, keep their congregation going, and then keep that role as part of that social connectedness.
You know, it's so interesting because I tried to talk to pastors and ministers from a broad swath. Some of them didn't make it into the article just because of limited space and time. But, you know, by and large, they kind of had this sense of acceptance. You know, they all seemed to say the church has fundamentally failed local communities, and that perhaps this ministers like to draw on the death and resurrection metaphor a lot, that's what they do with Jesus and all. And so a lot of them had this, that they were saying, you know, we have failed the community, and as a result, we're experiencing a death, but we hope from that we can have a regrowth. And there's a real interesting parallel between what rural churches are doing and what struggling urban churches are doing. So there's a lot of like coming together, sharing of resources, and it's almost like going back to the past with the traveling minister that used to, you know, ride from town to town and preach. There have been ministers who will share up to like 5 congregations with volunteer staff between them. And then also kind of try to come together to just bring together resources or even people in their congregations. And that is a parallel to what's happening in some struggling urban churches too. So in sharing buildings, I think in the article I included a story of a church in just over the border in Minnesota that has, you know, early in the morning they have a Korean congregation, and then after that they have a Hispanic congregation, and then after that it goes to an English-speaking congregation, all different denominations, but all kind of sharing resources and trying to serve their communities.
And Wayne, do we see that kind of a multi-purposing of churches here, and the sort of, I guess you'd call, it's like the old circuit riders back in the 1800s, pastors who went from church to church. Do we see that here?
Well, exactly, Rob. That, in fact, those are Methodist pastors that came to be known as the circuit riders. We're back to that again. There's one pastor I interviewed in a study I did out in South Dakota, a female Lutheran pastor who serves 4 congregations and has to drive over 100 miles each Sunday. When she hits all 4, it would be 260 miles, so she can't do that very often. But once in a while, she'll hit all 4 congregations. So it is definitely a trend, and sharing secretarial staff and so on. There are so many stories of congregations that have avoided closing and been able to keep going because of finding those kind of economies of scale. You have to understand, in some of these towns, especially out in the in the northern plains and in rural parts of Wisconsin, would be closer to home, that not only is it long distances between communities, but a lot of the services have closed, grocery stores have closed, gas stations have closed, oftentimes leaving only the church as the last building in town where you could have a public meeting or a performing arts space.
Talking to Liz Lenz. She's a writer. She wrote a piece on the decline of rural churches in the Midwest. And Wayne Thompson is with us, sociology professor at Carthage College in Kenosha, looking at rural churches in Wisconsin and elsewhere on the decline and the social role that they played maybe not being replaced. So, Wayne, part of the story you just mentioned is that rural and small-town communities are changing, declining services, things moving away in some places, in some cases. You also mentioned to me before the show they're in different communities. They're not their own standalone thing. Sometimes they're a bedroom community for a bigger urban area. So how is that changing that role of the church?
Well, you have to keep in mind that rural areas, as with urban areas, rural areas are very diverse. There are different kinds of rural areas. I grew up near Marshfield, Wisconsin, which is a farm area, a rural area. And then we have a cottage up in Lac des Flambeaux, which is a retirement area. There are also areas, boom and bust economies, like in western North Dakota, where there are churches that are and populations that are growing. So there's a lot of change in rural areas. that, and it isn't all decline, but overall it's experienced this decline, and there, thus there is this dominant narrative in small town and rural communities of loss, of the, you know, the resurrection metaphor that that Liz was talking about is definitely prominent, and it's not just in the churches, it's in the communities as a whole.
And Liz, as these churches decline or maybe their role changes, do people outside of the church even feel less like neighbors, less like they know the people in their own community?
Yes, that was a huge thing that everybody I talked to experienced. And it's one of the things that got me our article. Did we feel less like neighbors to each other? And, you know, I was looking around. One of the reasons that I came up with, but Erica Yusey, one of the ministers I spoke to, has a community in Swisher, Iowa, a church in Swisher, Iowa, which is feeds into Cedar Rapids, where I live. And she said it was just so difficult because nobody, you know, people live next door to each other, but they're all traveling into Cedar Rapids and then back out to the city, and that, you know, there's just no... there's no way to serve people, and because they're outside of the city, they're outside of some city services. So, you know, like if there's a single parent who might need some help with food or transportation or watching their child, there's social services, you know, have really been failing Americans in that way. And so, and the church in America has by and large come in to fill that gap, and she's, you know, she said that there's just no way to know who is here actually in the community because people just aren't part of their communities in the way that they used to be anymore.
Talking about the decline of rural churches, the role that they play, have played in small town communities. We have Liz Lenz with us. She's based in Iowa. She wrote a piece called The Death of the Midwestern Church. Wayne Thompson also with us, professor of sociology at Carthage College here in Wisconsin.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Is this a concern in your community? How important is your local church or other faith institution in your life, in your community? Is it a big part of your social life? Do you feel like it keeps you connected, or have you lost that over the years? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue our conversation now about the decline of rural churches with writer Liz Lenz and sociologist Wayne Thompson.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Does a small town or rural church play an important role in your community? Has that changed over the years? If you're part of a small town congregation, maybe even a church official yourself, what has you worried? What's going well? What are you trying maybe to do differently? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Wayne, you've said some churches are moving from what you call a generalist approach to a consumer orientation. So what does that mean at a practical level?
Well, you know, for urban churches and rural churches alike, they've had to adapt to a different kind of, you know, media environment. What people expect is that the church is going to meet their needs as opposed to a more European orientation where the church was all things to all people. So now people can vote with their feet. In the United States, religion is voluntary, right? So they can shop around for churches. For rural communities, that's meant a difference in the kinds of churches that are available. In addition to the usual mainline churches and Roman Catholic, some evangelical in the mix, you now also have these non-denominational churches at the edge of every town. So there's this new kind of competition, and the non-denominational churches are faster to pick up on changes in communication technology, ways of keeping in touch through the Internet that really affect their ability to deliver those services to rural people.
And Liz, do you see that going on where you are? These sometimes people call them mega churches. Maybe they're not all that big, but these non-denominational churches luring people away from the more traditional denominations?
Yeah, when I was digging into the statistics, especially for Iowa, that I saw, you know, that there has been, that the churches that are experiencing growth are these kind of urban-ish, right, on the edge of these urban, suburban, urban communities, and they're non-denominational. But the The problem with those churches is that they don't do that local service that the local parish does. You know, they have big, exciting bands, you know, like fun youth groups and activities and exciting pastors who wear hip clothes. But, you know, the boots on the ground level of service to the community is not being replicated by them. And that's the thing that concerns me most, is the people who were once served by churches, not in a spiritual sense, but in a very, you know, literal sense, people who were fed and clothed by the church. Where do they go now? And these big mega churches just, they're not doing that in a practical sense.
And Wayne, that reminds me, you sent me a note about the Robert Putnam concept of bowling alone, that we Americans aren't joining fraternal organizations, sports leagues as much, that sort of thing. And in a way, it sounds like we're churching alone. We might be going to these big churches as an individual experience for us, Wayne, and not as a communal experience. Do you think there's something to that?
Well, yeah, and when we do get involved with other people within the churches, it tends to be more niched in these non-denominational churches. There are two kinds of social capital that congregations can bring. One is bonding capital within the members. The non-denominational churches are very good at that. The other kind is what's called bridging social capital, which helps people connect through their church into the community. The kinds of activities that Liz is describing are bridging capital activities. And mainline Protestants and Roman Catholics have a long history of doing this kind of work. The non-denominational churches do get involved in soup kitchens and so on, but as Liz was pointing out, not as much.
Let's bring on a caller now. We've got Lauren on the line in Mineral Point. Lauren, hi. Hi.
Yes, hello there.
Go ahead.
I'm the member of a small church in southwest Wisconsin that started in 1847. However, the problem we have is aging. I'm 75, and I'm one of the younger members. And I think this is one of the problems we have. We aren't able to get younger people interested in religion and church. There are too many other things to do.
And Lauren, I want to ask, is this a case where young people are moving out of the area, or they're still there, it just church isn't on their radar?
For this small rural area, there are not that many young people. That's correct.
Lauren, thanks a lot for calling and sharing that. Wayne, do you think this is a common experience, that the denomination is getting older and the younger cohort is either moving away or just staying but not entering, not going to the church?
Well, here's where there's a difference, too, between the newer non-denominational churches, which tend to have a little bit younger profile, and the mainline Catholic churches, which have an older profile. But the broader changes that are going on in these communities involve a graying of rural America. The 65 and over age group are more represented in rural areas than in urban areas. And so the young people don't see economic opportunity, and they don't see the cultural amenities that are available maybe in college towns. And so it's off to Madison or, you know, other cities.
And Liz, as we start to wrap up, do you see anything replacing the role in rural communities that churches used to play, whether it's the churches themselves reinventing themselves or something else? I don't know what.
Well, one of the pastors that I spoke to, you know, said the church has been reinventing itself since the time it was the church, right? So this has always been kind of the struggle of religion, is to find relevance in our culture. But it was interesting to see the excitement there on the fringes for coming back in and finding a renewed sense of purpose and a renewed sense of community. So I would never pretend to know what this resurrection looks like, but I do think there is a change coming. I also see political changes coming too, where people, instead of looking to their local communities, are now looking to government to kind of come in and fill these gaps. And so, you know, that's the big American dilemma, right? Who's responsible for who? And so it will be interesting to see how that dynamic plays out in the next couple of years. Is it going to be the government that's going to step up, or are we going to step up and start being communities again? It will be interesting to see.
Well, we'll leave it there for now. Liz, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Wayne, thanks to you as well.
Thank you very much.
We've been hearing from Wayne Thompson, sociology professor at Carthage College in Kenosha, and Liz Lenz, blogger and writer. Her piece on rural churches, by the way, is linked on the Central Time Facebook page.
Several actions taken by Governor Scott Walker and Republican lawmakers have emerged as key issues in the election for Milwaukee County Executive. Incumbent Chris Abele is trying to fend off three challengers, including a Democratic state senator. Chuck Kornbeck has this preview of the February 16th primary contest.
Chris Abele comes from a wealthy family and has used some of that money to pay for a slew of pre-primary television ads that tout his 5 years as Milwaukee County Executive.
Chris Abele's cleaning up the mess. Balance the budget without raising taxes 5 years in a row, while increasing services.
But while Abele's ad also appears to take a swipe at the previous county executive, Governor Scott Walker, it's Abele's occasional partnerships with Walker and legislative Republicans that have another county executive candidate, Milwaukee State Senator Chris Larson, on the attack.
All right, let's get started. Thank you for being here at Lake Park.
Larson's news conference on Monday criticized Abele's support for a Republican-authored law that gives the county executive the ability to sell some county parks that are not zoned as parkland without the okay of the Milwaukee County Board. Larson says Abele has often teamed up with the GOP in Madison.
There's other pieces of legislation that he sought that would give him near unilateral authority on budgeting, as well as near unilateral authority on policy.
Last night in Milwaukee, Larson, Abele, and the other two men running for Milwaukee County Executive finally squared off face-to-face at a debate sponsored by local Democrats. Abele said he would not sell any county parks.
I've spent 20 years trying to do everything I can, not just saying, not just talking, committing real resources and working very hard and with some success to protect land and, since I've been at the county, increase parkland.
Abele says no one knew some county parkland isn't zoned as parks, and he's asked Milwaukee County communities to rezone their land to protect it. Abele took on Larson's concerns about cooperation with Republicans in an answer to a question about a GOP law that allows a locally appointed administrator to take over some failing Milwaukee public schools. Abele says he did not seek that authority.
But rather than just say, hey, you know, this is wrong and walk away from it, I'm taking legislation that did pass and trying to turn it into something good.
But Senator Larson says County Executive Abele should not have appointed a local school administrator.
It shouldn't have been passed, and the executive should not have done anything with it. And as executive, I would have done what the mayor did and said, no thanks. Because he knows this is designed by the same people who delivered the largest cut to education in our state's history.
Some public sector labor unions like AFSCME are supporting Larson. The other two candidates for Milwaukee County Executive are running lower profile campaigns. Entrepreneur Joe Klein, who's with the Wisconsin Pirate Party, is making a big push for more open government.
You know, I'm willing to, if need be, hang a camera above my desk. I'm certainly willing to put staff meetings on streaming video.
The fourth candidate, carpenter Steve Hogan, didn't say a lot during last night's debate, but he did pound down the state's Milwaukee Bucks arena financing deal that Chris Abele helped negotiate.
I think we should tell the NBA to go to hell. Nobody wants to spend $80 million of taxpayer money on a building because the Bradley Center doesn't have nice box seats for the rich people.
The two top vote-getters in the February 16th primary will square off again in April. Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. News is coming up next on Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.